Today is our first day of the 11th month, our new moon, and we're going to be picking back up in Joshua, starting in chapter 6. Just prior, we had covered Israel's crossing over the Jordan. We've covered the circumcision at Gilgal, the Passover that was held, Joshua meeting the captain of Yahweh's host, and loosing off his shoes and being informed that he was going to be fighting on behalf of God. So that's something all to consider while we read the commonly known story about Joshua and the walls of Jericho. And we're going to focus on some of the more unnoticed points and pick up on some of that. So Joshua chapter 6. Now Jericho was straitly shut up because of the children of Israel. None went out, and none came in. And Yahweh said unto Joshua, See, I have given into thine hand Jericho, and the king thereof, and the mighty men of valor. And ye shall compass the city, all ye men of war, and go round about the city once. Thus shalt thou do for 6 days. And 7 priests shall bear before the ark 7 trumpets of ram's horns. And the 7th day ye shall compass the city 7 times, and the priest shall blow with the trumpet, and it shall come to pass that when they make a long blast with the ram's horn, and when ye hear the sound of the trumpet, all the people shall shout with a great shout, and the wall of the city shall fall down flat, and the people shall ascend up every man straight before him. And Joshua the son of Nun called the priests, and said unto them, Take up the ark of the covenant, and let 7 priests bear 7 trumpets of ram's horns before the ark of Yahweh. And he said unto the people, Pass on and compass the city, and let him that is armed pass on before the ark of Yahweh. And it came to pass that when Joshua had spoken unto the people, that the 7 priests bearing the 7 trumpets of ram's horns passed on before Yahweh, and blew with the trumpets. And the ark of the covenant of Yahweh followed them. And the armed men went before the priests, and blew with the trumpets. And the rearward came after the ark, the priests going on and blowing with the trumpets. So here we see a very detailed explanation of how God wanted Joshua and the children of Israel to do things. And I think it's very important that we notice that God, our God, is a God of order. He's always laying things out specifically how he wants it done, numbering it, and making it to be so. Not because he couldn't drop the walls without this, most likely, but because he wanted it done a certain way, and it was constantly a test of faith by obedience. And I think that we can oftentimes see that the law or the commandments or just God's commands on certain subjects, which aren't laws all the time. God didn't tell every city to be besieged this way. But in this way, God commanded it to be done, and by doing it, it was a show of faith. And I think the general law, the general commandments of God that he teaches his people to do are ways for us to pattern our lives so that God knows that we are faithful, because a lot of the things God tells us to do, we don't understand. And a lot of what we don't understand is, why does there have to be so many priests, and why do there have to be so many trumpets? Why do there have to be men with that are armed in the front whenever you are going to win anyhow because of the sound of the trumpet? I mean, all of those questions we really have no answers for, but what we know is that God commanded it in a specific way because he wanted obedience. And because of the people's obedience, he was going to give them the city with very little force, even though he had armed men among them. So I think that there's a precedence we can see about the personality and the attitude of the God of the Bible when it comes to obeying his words, that his obedience, or the obedience that we have to him, rather, is based on the simple fact that he said so, and he wants to see how well we want to listen. I think that that's an important part of who God is. Verse 10, And Joshua had commanded the people, saying, Ye shall not shout, nor make any noise with your voice, neither shall any word proceed out of your mouth, until the day I bid you shout. Then shall you shout. So the ark of Yahweh compassed the city, going about it once, and they came into the camp, and they lodged in the camp. And Joshua rose early in the morning, and the priests took up the ark of Yahweh, and seven priests bearing seven trumpets of ram's horns, not bull's horns or not antelope horns, but ram's horns. You see a very specific command again. Before the ark of Yahweh, and it went on continually, and blew with the trumpets, and the armed men went before them, but the rearward came after the ark of Yahweh, the priests going on and blowing with the trumpets. And the second day they compassed the city once and returned into the camp. So they did 6 days. So we're getting told that the people specifically did what God told them to do. And you have to think that the people of Jericho are looking out the windows and wondering, what in the world are these guys doing? You know, but then again, Jordan just got split. So I'm sure it was the second thing on their mind was, what are they doing? You know, they pretty much knew what was going to happen according to Rahab's testimony. So 15 says, and it came to pass on the seventh day that they rose early about the dawning of the day, and they compassed the city after the same manner seven times, only on that day they compassed the city seven times. And it came to pass at the seventh time, when the priests blew with the trumpets, Joshua said to the people, shout, for Yahweh has given you the city, and the city shall be accursed, even it, and all that are therein to Yahweh. Only Rahab the harlot shall live, she and all that are with her in the house, because she hid the messengers that we sent. And ye in any wise keep yourselves from the accursed thing, lest you make yourself accursed when you take of the accursed thing and make the camp of Israel a curse and trouble it. But all the silver and gold, the vessels of brass and iron, are consecrated unto Yahweh. They shall come into the treasury of Yahweh. So we have then yet in the command to shout another command that's being told them, that there's this accursed thing, these accursed elements of the people of Jericho that they are not allowed to take of. And if anyone takes it or tries to take God's stuff, the stuff that God wants, the gold and silver and brass and iron that are consecrated, it's going to be a curse. So it's yet now a negative command. Everything prior to this was positive law. It was saying, you will do this, you will do this. Now there's a negative law, do not do that. Okay, and then after that, in 20, he says, so the people shouted when the priests blew with the trumpets, and it came to pass when the people heard the sound of the trumpet, and the people shouted with a great shout, that the wall fell down flat, so that the people went up into the city, every man straight before him, and they took the city. They utterly destroyed all that was in the city, both man and woman, young and old, and ox and sheep and ass with the edge of the sword. But Joshua had said unto the two men that had spied out the country, go into the harlot's house and bring out thence the woman and all that she hath, as ye swear unto her. And the young men that were spies went in and brought out Rahab. And her father, and her mother, and her brethren, and all that she had, and they brought out all her kindred, and left them without the camp of Israel. So at this time, they actually take Rahab out of the gates, and they put her outside of the camp. But she doesn't stay there, as we'll see by reading on into the camp. But notice that it says that they took all of her kindred. And the other day, when we were talking yesterday, when we were talking about why Rahab may have been spared, considering most people want to believe that she's a Canaanite, we remembered that Rahab, number one, was not a Canaanite name according to Bible dictionaries. Secondly, the word whore or harlot that is being used there could be referencing her being involved with Canaanites, not necessarily that she was a whore of the idea that she did things for money. And the next is that only her kindred, mother, father, and brother, were saved according to the word. So we see that Rahab, even here, is it said specifically that her kindred was left, which I think is even further evidence for the idea that she was probably not a Canaanite by ethnicity, but that she was some other type of people that God did not command their destruction. Making God true once again and not a liar. 24 goes on to say, "And they burnt the city with fire, and all that was therein, only the silver and gold, the vessels of brass and of iron, they put into the treasury of the house of Yahweh. Joshua saved Rahab the harlot alive, and her father's household, and all that she had, and she dwelleth in Israel even unto this day, because she hid the messengers which Joshua sent to spy out Jericho. And Joshua adjured them at that time, saying, Cursed be the man before Yahweh that rises up and builds the city of Jericho. He shall lay the foundation thereof in his firstborn, and in his youngest son shall he set up the gates of it. So Yahweh was with Joshua, and his fame was noised throughout all the country." So we see here that not only was Rahab saved and set outside of the camp, but after the entire battle of Jericho was done, that they accepted Rahab to live among the children of Israel as one of the people, which definitely, according to the other parts of God's law in Deuteronomy and other places, would not have been extended to the Canaanites in any other place. So on top of that, we have the curse that is pronounced over Jericho, that nobody was to ever build Jericho again. And if he did do so, he would do so in his firstborn and in his youngest son. Which this was fulfilled, I think most people know this, but just for the sake of saying it, by a guy named Hillel the Bethelite in the days of Ahab the king. And that is in 1 Kings 16:34. You can find that exact statement. And it seems like at that time there was a custom that this guy observed, probably somehow related to Moloch worship, that a person actually would sacrifice his son on the wall and bury him under the foundation as some kind of a consecrated ritual. And this actually happened and was recorded in the days of Ahab, king of Israel. Disgustingly enough. So God said it through the mouth of Joshua, and it came to pass. So in 7, verse 1, it says, "But the children of Israel committed a trespass in the accursed thing. For Achan, the son of Carmi, the son of Zabdi, the son of Zerah, of the tribe of Judah, took of the accursed thing, and the anger of Yahweh was kindled against the children of Israel." I find it incredibly interesting, considering what we said the other day, what I called attention to, was the scarlet thread that was tied to Rahab's window, the scarlet thread that was tied to when Zerah and Pharez were born, draws a connection to the idea that perhaps Rahab was even an outcast from the line of Zerah, the line of Judah, of the tribe of Judah, I mean. And then the person who commits the trespass and the accursed thing is from that same exact line. So a person is accepted, a family is accepted into Israel. Possibly, we can speculate and say there's a good possibility due to the symbology of the scarlet thread into Israel that were redeemed, Rahab's house. And then there is Achan, who commits this trespass we're going to read about, who's also from Zerah of the tribe of Judah, a member of the scarlet thread family, going to tell us that good people can become bad and bad people can become good. And you just really never know which direction things are going in. It says, "He took of the accursed thing, and the anger of Yahweh was kindled against the children of Israel. Joshua sent men from Jericho to Ai, which is beside Beth Avon, on the east side of Bethel. And he spake unto them, saying, Go up and view the country. And the men went up and they viewed Ai." So now they're looking at Ai, which is another village, another town, which, according to archaeology, is just about as fortified as Jericho, only it did not have the wall. We just recently seen an archaeology video by David Roll, which I recommend anybody to look at if you want a biblical take on these events, that he concluded everything was absolutely true that the Bible says about the fall of Jericho, and that Ai also was another big city, strong city, full of strong people also, that Israel was going to come against. It says, "And they returned to Joshua in 3 and said unto him, Let not all the people go up, but let about 2,000 or 3,000 men go up and smite Ai, and make not all the people to labor thither, for they all are but few." So he's saying Ai is just a little town. There ain't nothing to worry about there. We can take them out easy. "And the men of Ai smote of them..." I'm sorry, I skipped 4. "So there went up thither of the people about 3,000 men." They got millions of people who cross over the Jordan to fight, and they only sent 3,000 up. And they say, "Ah, we're going to take this town easy. No problem. We don't have anything to worry about." But it says they fled before the men of Ai. They turned around and ran away. "The men of Ai smote of them about 36 men," which isn't a whole big number, but nobody wants to lose life. "For they chased them from before the gate even unto Shebarim, and they smote them in the going down, wherefore the hearts of the people melted and became as water." So now the reverse. When we read about the people coming into Jericho, the people of Jericho's hearts melted like water, it says, and now Israel's hearts are melting. It's that feeling you get in your chest when you get scared, where it kind of feels like something's draining down into your belly. Okay, and that's the way the Israel's feeling. Oh no, we got Jericho, but we can't do the rest. They're starting to wonder what happened. 6, "And Joshua rent his clothes and fell to the earth upon his face before the ark of Yahweh until the eventide," so until evening, "he and the elders of Israel, and they put dust upon their heads. And Joshua said, Alas, O Lord God, wherefore hast thou at all brought this people over Jordan to deliver us into the hand of the Amorites to destroy us? Would to God we had been content and dwelt on the other side Jordan. O Lord, what shall I say when Israel turns their backs before their enemies? For the Canaanites and all the inhabitants of the land shall hear of it, and shall envron us round, and cut off our name from the earth. And what wilt thou do unto thy great name? And Yahweh said to Joshua, Get thee up! Wherefore liest thou thus upon thy face? Israel sinned. They have also transgressed my covenant, which I commanded them, for they have even taken of the accursed thing, and they have also stolen, and they have dissembled also, and they have put it even among their own stuff." So Joshua, like any good leader, and as we discussed before, that good leaders have to show the people the way to go, to teach the people how they should act in times of trouble. Joshua immediately rips his clothes, makes himself uncomfortable, fasts before God, and begs God's guidance on, what am I going to say? Your people, your chosen people, are now afraid, and they're wanting to turn away, and they want to run. And what am I going to say? And God doesn't politely tell him, Joshua, you know, your people have just done something a little bit wrong. Come on, look at it. He says, get up. Get off your face. You know what? Do you think I've done this for nothing? I did it because I told you not to do something. You know, don't beg me to change something. You're going to change, and then I'll change. I'll change the situation once you repent. Because once again, you know, God's demonstrating the idea that repentance is the thing that he's looking for. He's looking for the heart. God's always looking for the heart. And somebody in Israel, one of Christ's relatives, interestingly enough, out of the tribe of Judah, if you went far enough back, is the one who did not do the right thing. They had transgressed not only in not keeping God's covenant, doing what he said, but they've stolen from God. They've taken something that was his, and they put it among their own stuff, and now they've caused Israel to stand. So picking up at 12. Therefore the children of Israel could not stand before their enemies, but they turned their backs before their enemies because they were accursed. Neither will I be with you any more, except ye destroy the accursed thing from among you. Now that's putting it pretty bluntly. God says, unless you get the curse off of you, unless you repeal the curse, I'm not helping anymore. You don't want my help? You don't want to listen? I don't want to help you. So it's a pretty straightforward solution God has for them. And he's more than willing to help Israel figure it out. 13. Up, sanctify the people, and say, sanctify yourself against tomorrow. For thus saith Yahweh, God of Israel, there is an accursed thing in the midst of thee, O Israel. Thou canst not stand before thine enemies until ye take away the accursed thing from among you. I think it's interesting that the word sanctify, which means make yourself holy or clean yourself, is also another reference to the way that people would cleanse themselves in a baptismal type way, the shadow, if you will, for baptism out of God's law was a type of sanctification. And you can see this all the way back into Genesis when Jacob tells his children at Bethel to sanctify themselves also, and tells them to sanctify themselves and to bury all the idols and things like that underneath the tree. I can't remember the town, it might have been in Shechem, where they bury their stuff under the tree, and he calls them to a repentance of their works and their ways, and they go to Bethel and they worship together. And so there's, in some ways, a way that Joshua is calling the people to sanctify themselves, to make themselves holy, to wash themselves for the next day, to contemplate themselves. You know, it's not just an outward cleansing, but an inward cleansing that he's asking them to do, so that the people could understand what they've done wrong. I don't think Joshua thought that it was going to be such an obvious sin, that it was actually an intentional thing, is what it turns out to be. 14. And in the morning, therefore, ye shall be brought according to your tribes. And it shall be that the tribe which Yahweh takes shall come according to the families thereof, and the family which Yahweh shall take shall come by households. And the household which Yahweh shall take shall come man by man, or warrior by warrior. There's that word geber again that we talked about the other day, where it says a woman shall not dress as a geber or as a warrior, as a man, and a man shall not dress as a woman, where we discussed that the actual meaning of that was talking about warfare, a woman acting like a warrior. And there's the same place, they shall come warrior by warrior, is actually how the Hebrew text would read it. The idea of man is being conveyed in that way. And it shall be that he that is taken with the accursed thing shall be burnt with fire, he and all that he hath, because he hath transgressed the covenant of Yahweh, and because he has wrought folly in Israel. Now there's only two other offenses in God's law that require such a thing. One is when a priest's daughter commits whoredom, and the other is whenever a man is a sorcerer or a wizard who is a witch. Those are the only two things that in God's law requires someone to be burnt with fire. But unlike our cruel European ancestors who did this while people were alive, God did this after the people were dead, because our God wasn't, I don't think, is that cruel. He's not a God of torture. He's a God of justice. And death is much justice. The ashes were for the people to see. But the idea to be conveyed here, I think, is that this is the type of trespass that is so grievous to God that it's equated to witchcraft, which kind of brings the words of Saul to light, Samuel rather, to Saul, where he says rebellion is as the sin of witchcraft. And in the case of a Levite or a priest's daughter committing whoredom was in a way also a type of witchcraft, or a type of dealing with other gods, because it was such a heinous thing for the people to see done that it needed punished severely. 16. So Joshua rose up early in the morning, and he brought Israel by their tribes, and the tribe of Judah was taken. And he brought the family of Judah, and he took the family of the Zerahites. And he brought the family of the Zerahites man by man, and Zabdi was taken. And he brought his household man by man, and Achan, the son of Carmi, the son of Zabdi, the son of Zerah, of the tribe of Judah, was taken. You don't get much more specific than that. And Joshua said unto Achan, My son, give, I pray thee, glory to Yahweh, God of Israel, and make confession unto him, and tell me now what thou hast done. Hide it not from me. And Achan answered Joshua and said, Indeed, I have sinned. And there's our word again, if I'm not mistaken. Amen, truly. Belief, faith, the same idea. He opens up with the idea. He says, of faith, faithfully I have sinned. You know, you're definitely right. I have sinned against Yahweh, the God of Israel, and thus have I done. When I saw among the spoils a goodly Babylonish garment, 200 shekels of silver, and a wedge of gold of 50 shekels weight, I coveted them. I took them, and behold, they are hid in the earth in the midst of my tent, and the silver under it. So Joshua sent messengers, and they ran unto the tent, and behold, it was hid in his tent, and the silver was under it. And they took them out of the midst of the tent, and they brought them unto Joshua and unto all the children of Israel, and laid them out before Yahweh. And Joshua and all Israel with him took Achan the son of Zerah, the silver and the garment, and the wedge of gold, and his sons and his daughters, his oxen, his asses, his sheep, his tent, and all that he had. They brought them unto the valley of Achor, which is a very significant place in Israelite history. The valley of Achor has always been a valley for damnation, a valley of judgment from this time forward. It was always remembered the valley of Achan and the valley of Achor. And Joshua said, Why hast thou troubled us? And Yahweh shall trouble thee this day. And all Israel stoned him with stones, and then burned him with fire. And they had stoned them after they had stoned them with stones. So you notice here that not only did they stone him, which in many ways some people think it's a real cruel way to put somebody to death, but once you get smacked in the head the first time with a big rock, you're unconscious, and after that they finish you off. It's been proven to be a much more just way to do things than even the electric chair, for sure. But the point is, they burn them afterwards. And so the question should be asked, and I think most people would want to ask the question, why did they kill his sons, his daughters, his animals, his tent, everything? Why'd they do that? The animals in the tent, I can't really answer the question other than it had a symbolism behind it. But the sons and the daughters obviously knew about what had happened. They obviously knew in the middle of their home, the middle of their tent, Dad dug a hole and buried a bunch of stuff that God said, don't do, that's bad, you know, that's accursed. And while a lot of thought has been given to this contradicting God's law in the sense that you should not put a son and a daughter or so forth to death for the sins of their parents, it in reality shows us that if God is true and if we believe God's word, then that was not the case. They were not executing judgment upon his children based on the sin of the father. They were being tried for their own sins as well. They were knowledgeable of what Dad had done, and they held their peace. They didn't go and tell somebody like they should have. Okay, so this also gives us an idea of understanding, while family has its place and family should be respected, that they should have went to maybe Grandpa or Uncle so-and-so and said, Dad just buried the accursed thing in the middle of the living room. I think we need to deal with this. You know, but instead they went, ooh, gold, Babylonian garments. You know, we're going to wear that. We'll have nice dresses. You know, it was a matter of covetous for the whole family. So 26 says, they raised over him a great heap of stones unto this day. So Yahweh turned from the fierceness of his anger. Wherefore The name of the place was called the Valley of Achor unto this day. Chapter 8. And Yahweh said unto Joshua, Fear not, neither be thou dismayed. Take all the people of war with thee, and arise and go up to Ai. See, I have given into thy hand the king of Ai, and his people, and his city, and his land. And thou shalt do to Ai and her king as thou didst unto Jericho and her king. Only the spoil thereof and the cattle thereof shall ye take for a prey unto yourselves. Lay thee an ambush for the city behind it. So in this case, we have something to contrast here that we haven't seen before. The first time when the men decide they're going to go to Ai and they're going to war, they're going to fight against Ai, God does not send them to go. God didn't speak. They said of themselves, hey, let's go up to Ai. It's a weak city. We're going to take it with 3,000 men, and this will be easy. No problems. And instead, they lose 36 people. Okay, in this case, God tells Joshua, he says, go up to Ai. Everything's in order. I give you charge to do it. I'm behind you. Lay an ambush for the city, and you can have it. And in this case, he says, if Achan would have just waited, if he would have just not acted on his covetousness, in this city, God says, this one, you can have the stuff for yourself. I'm giving you this one. But see, God always keeps the first fruits. Okay, the first fruits have always been holy to God in all situations. The spoils of war are mentioned in the law as well as being holy unto God. And so anytime something comes out of agriculture or comes out of an animal or comes out of a human even, the firstborn son of a man was to be redeemed. The firstborn son of God was another testament to that. This Jericho was the first victory on the other side of Jordan in the land of promise that God promised Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So it was sanctified before it ever happened that this was God's. Okay? So what Achan was judged for by being covetous was actually, in a way, breaking the first commandment. He was putting himself before God. Okay? He took God's stuff, God's first fruits. Of this, which was a consecration and a blessing on God's priesthood that was going to help facilitate the tabernacle. So there was a lot more going on in Israel than just simply losing a couple wedges of gold and some garments. But in this new city, like I said, he's going to get, the people are going to be allowed to take as a prey. Okay, so verse 3. So Joshua arose and all the people of war to go up against Ai. Joshua chose out 30,000 mighty men of valor, and he sent them away by night. Interesting. 30,000 people versus 3,000 is a huge difference in the way God instructs this battle to actually go. And he commanded them, saying, Behold, ye shall lie in wait against the city, even behind the city, go not very far from the city, but be ye all ready. And I and all the people that are with me will approach unto the city. And it shall come to pass that when they come out against us, as at the first, that we will flee before them, for they will come out after us, until we have drawn them from the city. For they will say, They flee before us, and at the first, therefore, we will flee before them. And ye shall rise up from the ambush, and ye shall seize the city, for Yahweh your God will deliver it into your hand. And it shall be that when you have taken the city, that ye shall set the city on fire, according to the commandment of Yahweh shall ye do. See, I have commanded you. So it's also an interesting thing that God tells Joshua, set an ambush. That's actually all he tells them to do, and the people developed the ambush. God didn't say, do it this way, do it exactly that way. When God leaves it open for human interpretation, for man's understanding, he's okay with you developing the ambush the way that he told you to do it. You fill in the details. But in the case God says, I want it this way, I want this number, I want this amount, I want you to approach from this side, you got to do it God's way. So it's not like God's always saying, do things exactly like this, to the point. He just wants obedience in all of the ways that he asks. And at times he doesn't ask for things. He says, I want you to figure this one out. Kind of like I think you deal with children sometimes, is in order to let them develop their own skills and their own understanding, they have to sometimes do their own things. Other times, God spells it out for them. 9 says, Joshua therefore sent them forth, and they went to lie in ambush and abode between Bethel and Ai on the west side of Ai, but Joshua lodged that night among the people. And Joshua rose up early in the morning, and he numbered the people, and he went up, he and the elders of Israel, before the people to Ai. And all the people, even the people of war that were with him, went up. They drew nigh, and they came before the city, and they pitched on the north side of Ai. Now there was a valley between them and Ai. And he took about 5,000 men. He set them to lie in the ambush between Bethel and Ai on the west side of the city. And when they had set the people, even all the host that was on the north of the city, and their liers in wait on the west of the city, Joshua went that night into the midst of the valley. And it came to pass that when the king of Ai saw it, that he hastened and he rose up early, and the men of the city went out against Israel to battle, he and all his people, at the time appointed, before the plain. But he wist not that there were liars in ambush against him behind the city. So the king gets up, looks out the window or off the tower or however it went, and then he says, look at that. These guys, we chased them off once, we chased them off again. Let's go get them. So they just storm out of the castle or out of the wall or wherever they're at, and he goes out to get them, but he doesn't even pay attention because he's so confident that he's going to beat them again that there are people waiting for him to leave the city and leave it open. And there's nothing he's going to be able to do about it if he makes that move. So they have a pretty good strategy here. 15 says, and Joshua and all Israel made as if they were beaten. So they acted. They said, they ran away. They're acting like they're running and they're scared again. And Ai's probably wondering, why do these guys keep coming back? And they fled by the way of the wilderness. And all the people that were in Ai were called together to pursue after them. So now Ai calls the entire army out of the city and says, let's really put these guys down. They beat Jericho. They're not going to beat us. And they pursue after Joshua, and they were drawn away from the city. There was not a man left in Ai or Bethel. So not only Ai came, but now the town of Bethel, or the townsfolk of Bethel, decide they're going to come out and fight too. And they went not out after Israel, and they left the city open. I think you could say wide open. And they pursued after Israel. And Yahweh said unto Joshua, stretch out your spear that is in your hand towards Ai, for I will give it into thine hand. And Joshua stretched out the spear that he had in his hand towards the city, and the ambush arose quickly out of their place. They ran as soon as he had stretched out his hand. They entered into the city, and they took it. They hasted, and they set the city on fire. So, burns up, starts to burn. And it says, when the men of Ai looked behind them, and they saw the smoke of their city ascending up to heaven, they had no power to flee this way or that way. So they just stopped and looked, saddened. And the people that fled to the wilderness turned back upon the pursuers. And when Joshua and all Israel saw that the ambush had taken the city, and that the smoke of the city ascended, then they turned and they slew the men of Ai. And the others issued out of the city against them, so that there were in the midst of Israel some on this side and some on that side. And they smote them, so that they let none of them remain or escape. And the king of Ai they took alive. They brought him to Joshua. And it came to pass that when Israel had made an end of slaying all the inhabitants of Ai in the field, in the wilderness, wherein they chased them, and when they were all fallen on the edge of the sword, until they were consumed, that all Israelites returned unto Ai and smote it with the edge of the sword. 25. And so it was that all that fell that day, both of men and women, were 12,000, even all the men of Ai. For Joshua drew not his hand back, wherewith he stretched out the spear, until he had utterly destroyed the inhabitants of Ai. So Joshua stood there with that spear stretched out towards the city the entire time until it was over with. He said, I'm going to be obedient, and I'm not going to drop this spear until it's all over. He probably remembered Moses, when Moses held his arms up over the Amalekites. And if you remember, when Moses dropped his hands, they failed, and when he rose them, so what happened? Joshua and another man held his arms up for him. They said, we got to help. You know, we got to keep his arms up. So similar situation there. 27 says, only the cattle and the spoils of the city Israel took for a prey unto themselves, according to the word of Yahweh, which he commanded Joshua. Joshua burnt Ai and made it a heap forever, even a desolation unto this day. And the king of Ai he hanged on a tree until eventide. And as soon as the sun went down, Joshua commanded that they should take his carcass down from the tree and cast it at the entering in of the gate of the city, and raised thereon a great heap of stones that remains unto this day. So Israel has taken two cities now, been victorious, and so far as we know, have only lost 36 men, which is pretty amazing. Jericho and Ai. Then Joshua built an altar unto Yahweh, God of Israel, in Mount Ebal, as Moses, the servant of Yahweh, commanded the children of Israel, as it is written in the book of the law of Moses, an altar of whole stones, over which no man has lifted up any iron. And they offered thereon burnt offerings unto Yahweh, and sacrificed peace offerings. And he wrote upon the stones a copy of the law of Moses, which he wrote in the presence of the children of Israel. And all Israel and their elders and officers and their judges stood on this side of the ark, and on that side before the priests, the Levites, which bear the ark of the covenant of Yahweh, as well as the stranger, or the traveler, as he that was born among them, half of them over against Mount Gerizim, and half of them over against Mount Ebal, as Moses the servant of Yahweh commanded before, that they should bless the people of Israel. And I think we read that in Deuteronomy chapter 27, 28, when the blessings and the curses were made. Well, now they're actually in the land, they're actually able to do what Moses told them to do, and they're going to do it according to the word of God. And it's symbolizing the entrance into the promised land unto Abraham, so that the people are being obedient once again. 34. Afterwards he read all the words of the law, the blessings and the cursings, according to all that is written in the book of the law. There was not a word of all that Moses commanded, which Joshua read not before the congregation of Israel, with the women and the little ones, and the strangers that were conversant among them. Conversant means that they walked among them. It doesn't just mean conversation. I think we've heard this enough times, but conversation back in Old English or in this time frame did not mean just to speak, but it meant the customs, the manners. They understood the ways of Israel. And the literal Hebrew says that those that walked among them. So, I think that that's put there, though. I think that that specific mention is put there to let us know that when Joshua was leader, he made sure that everybody was following God's law. He wanted to make sure that nothing God told Moses and Israel to do, he was going to let alone. That he was going to teach the people by example, and that he was going to do exactly what God wanted, and he was going to remind them of the consequences if they did not follow God's law. Which, right before the next section that we're going to read, is a good thing to remember, because here is a place where we're going to read that Israel did drop the ball a little bit, and I believe it's this next section that is the reason why Israel was thrust out of the land, according to what God told them to do. Chapter 9. And it came to pass, when all the kings which were on this side Jordan, in the hills and in the valleys, and in all the coasts of the great sea over against Lebanon, the Hittite, the Amorite, the Canaanite, the Perizzite, the Hivite, the Jebusite, heard thereof, that they gathered themselves together to fight with Joshua and with Israel with one accord. And when the inhabitants of Gibeon heard what Joshua had done unto Jericho and to Ai, they did work slyly. And they went and they made as if they had been ambassadors. They took old sacks upon their asses, and wine bottles that were old and rent and bound up, old shoes clotted upon their feet, and old garments upon them, and all the bread of their provisions was dry and moldy. So here's these Canaanites, these guys, these Gibeonites, who are going to pretend that they aren't part of the hill country people, the ones that are gathered together to fight Israel. It says that all of the other Canaanite people and the Perizzites, which we have to remember are not Canaanites, but are another people, have gathered themselves together, and they're going to war against Israel and to try to defeat them. They're going to put all their armies together for a big, big war. And Gibeon is so afraid, they said, "No, we're not doing that. We're not going along with you guys. We're going to come and work slyly against Israel. We're going to deceive them into thinking we're ambassadors. Old clothes, old wine bottles, everything's old. And we've traveled so far," they're going to say. So let's read it. It says in 6, "And they went to Joshua unto the camp at Gilgal, and said unto him and to the men of Israel, We be come from a far country. Now therefore make ye a league with us." Emphasis added. "And the men of Israel said unto the Hivites, Peradventure ye dwell among us, and how shall we make a league with you? And they said to Joshua, Oh, we are thy servants. And Joshua said unto them, Who are ye? And from whence come ye? And they said unto him, From a very far country thy servants are come, because of the name of Yahweh your God. For we have heard of the fame of him, and of all that he did in Egypt, and all that he did to the two kings of the Amorites that were beyond Jordan, to Sihon king of Heshbon, and Og the king of Bashan, which was at Ashtaroth. Wherefore our elders and all the inhabitants of our country spake to us, saying, Take victuals with you for the journey, and go to meet them, and say unto them, We are your servants, therefore now make ye a league with us. This our bread we took hot," you know, here we got bread hot from the oven, now look at it, "provisions out of our houses on that day. We came forth to go unto you, but now, behold, it's dry and moldy. These bottles of wine which were filled were new. Behold, they are rent. These are garments, and our shoes are become old by reason of this very long journey." Everything's a complete lie. "And the men took of their victuals and asked not counsel at the mouth of Yahweh." So, what was the problem? What didn't they do?
They didn't ask counsel.
No counsel. No counsel. They didn't ask God about his opinion, did they?
No.
"And Joshua made peace with them." So he pledged peace, and he made a league with them, and he let them live. "And the princes of the congregation then swore unto them. And it came to pass that at the end of 3 days, after they had made the league with them, that they heard that they were their neighbors, and that they dwelt among them." They heard they were Canaanites. "And the children of Israel journeyed and came unto their cities on the 3rd day. Now their cities were Gibeon, and Kephirah, and Beeroth, and Kirjath-Jearim, And the children of Israel smote them not, because the princes of the congregation had sworn unto them by Yahweh God of Israel. And all the congregation murmured then against the princes. But all the princes said unto all the congregation, had sworn unto them by Yahweh God of Israel, and all the congregation murmured against the princes, it says. But all the princes said unto all the congregation, we have sworn unto them by Yahweh God of Israel, now therefore we may not touch them. This we will do to them. We will even let them live, lest wrath be upon us, because of the oath which we swear unto them. And the princes said unto them, let them live, but let them be hewers of wood and drawers of water unto all the congregation, as the princes had promised them. So we have a little bit of a discrepancy here between the people and the princes, or the government. Basically, the government of the people, the princes of the people, said, we swore an oath. God's going to be mad at us. He's going to punish us if we break our oath, which God probably would have. And the people were angry with the princes because they said, God said to kill these guys. They're going to be, you know, thorns in our side and pricks in our eyes. God says that if we don't do this, we're going to have a hard time. So the princes come up with a grand idea. This is what government seems to always do. The grand idea is that we're going to ignore the law of God, and we're going to make slaves out of them. And they'll serve you guys, the congregation. They'll serve the people, so we'll make everybody happy. We won't get rid of them like God says. Instead, we'll appease the people. And the people seem like, well, okay, we don't got to cut our own wood and draw our own water. That's a great idea. But meanwhile, God's law festers in the background. And apparently over this, maybe because God gave them the law and told them what would happen if they didn't do this, God winks at it. God lets it fester. Because God warned them, if we go back into Exodus and Deuteronomy, God warned them, if you do not utterly destroy these people, they will eventually corrupt you to a point where I will take away the land I swore to your fathers. Okay, because the reason I'm getting rid of them is because of their wickedness, because of the things I don't like about them. And the people at this point are making one of the biggest decisions in Israelite history that will affect us forever. And Joshua, apparently, because of the way government worked back then, where it was a government by the people, but it was yet a government ruled by the princes, and he was the highest judge, apparently could not change this situation, or he didn't notice it. We're not exactly sure what's going on, but what we know is that the princes are the ones who are pushing the issue and coming up with the grand idea to appease the people with slavery instead of the law of God. 22 says, Joshua called for them, and he spake unto them, saying, wherefore have you beguiled us, saying, we are very far from you, when you dwell among us? Now therefore ye are cursed, and there shall none of you be freed from being bondmen and hewers of wood and drawers of water for the house of my God. And they answered Joshua and said, because it was certainly told thy servants how that Yahweh thy God commanded his servant Moses to give you all the land and to destroy all the inhabitants of the land from before you. Therefore we were sore afraid for our lives because of you, and have done this thing. And now behold, we are in your hand, as it seems good and right unto thee to do unto us, do. And so did he unto them, and delivered them out of the hand of the children of Israel, and they slew them not. And Joshua made them that day hewers of wood and drawers of water for the congregation and for the altar of Yahweh, even unto this day, in the place which he should choose. So in other words, it says he did this even unto the day that where it talks about the place he should choose is talking about the temple. When the temple was built in Mount Zion in Jerusalem, these Canaanites were still there. They were still among the people all the way until the time that Joshua was written down. And after that, by the editor, whoever the person is, that the scribe that was writing Joshua's words down again for the people, which some people say was Ezra, or Samuel, that this was a common occurrence, that in the very temple of God these people were doing this. And I believe it is in the very end of the book of Zechariah, which I'm going to turn to real quick. If you can turn to Zechariah quick. That it kind of ends with this idea in the very last part, the very, very last verse in the book of Zechariah, which would be chapter 14. And I am going to read starting in 20. It says, "In that day," referring to a great day when God is going to return with blessings to Israel. Maybe the end of time, maybe the end of the age. I don't know exactly where this falls out. But it says, "In that day there shall be upon the bells of the horses holiness unto Yahweh. All the pots in Yahweh's house shall be like the bowls before the altar. Yea, every pot in Jerusalem and in Judah shall be holiness unto Yahweh of hosts. And all that sacrifice shall come and take of them inside therein." And he finalizes it by saying, "In that day there shall be no more Canaanite in the house of Yahweh of hosts." So apparently, even up into the time of Zechariah, the prophet, who was a post-captivity prophet to Israel, they didn't change the situation. The Canaanites had been clung to the people of the Levites and of Israel for quite some time. Most people think that he wrote from 631 to 621 BC, which in that case would have been, you know, definitely it would have been before Josiah and his reforms in that time period. But there was a time the people were looking forward to, even in that day, that this was going to change. And we're also told that the Gibeonites were smote by King Saul, and that he was going to do something, but he went about it in an entirely wrong way, and God cursed the people for doing what they were doing. So this specific situation may have been God sent. It may have been that God used the Canaanites to move Israel across the world. He used this situation as a launch pad to get them out of the promised land and to affect what they eventually became. We're not exactly sure why, but what we know is that this situation affected Israel throughout the rest of their history, and I would venture to say that unfortunately it's probably affecting Israel right now. It's just a matter of figuring out who's deceiving us and who is trying to be our neighbors and saying that they just want to be part of our culture and part of our people. I think it would be fairly easy to find them if we looked for it. So that will conclude today's Bible study.